Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Firstly, good evening, John.
And good evening to you, Ben. Hi, everybody.
Hi, everyone, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. We'd love to hear from you. And the text and WhatsApp number this evening, as ever, is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. Also available live on the World Wide Web at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Lots to look forward to, John, over the next week or so. The partial eclipse of the moon coming up on Saturday. And we'll be letting you know when to see it and where to see it. And but first we'll start off with things there are just to see in the sky. Yeah. And we'll start, of course, with the planets.
Yeah. I'm going to start off with the moon, actually, because it was interesting driving in this evening. And if you look up the Terminator, because it's quite clear out, this is one that's it's starting to feel chilly, so you get a slightly clearer night vision.
Usually, yes,
as well.
Right.
And I was just looking at it. Sun seems to be hitting just that particular rough patch on the Terminator this evening. And just up the top two-thirds, say go two-thirds up, it looks like there's a dip and there's a light leak as well. So you come down a little bit from the top, there's a little blip of light coming in, and then it comes, and it looks really rough down the whole way. So I must check to see. I have never seen that before. There's an X and a Y up there at a particular time of the month as well, and that's quite interesting to see. I've seen that. This one, with this little light leak. Now, if you are going out this evening,
it's not going to sunlight going through a valley or
a valley or
something,
a crater or something
mountains
like
or craters.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to see. And I got it quite clearly tonight, which was really good. I've never seen it before. And if you have a chance just in the next little while to do that, because it's not going to be like that for the next few days, because, as we know, the sun sort of creeps its way across with the Terminator up to full moon this particular weekend. I think full moon's on Saturday. Yep, and we'll go into that in a little bit more. Now, let's go back to the normal planets. And I've got this funny app on my phone that shows us exactly where we are in real time with the planets. And you can see that Mercury is out of sight. It's in conjunction with the Sun at the moment. Venus is a brilliant -4.5 in Leo, shines high in the east just before and during dawn. That's a fantastic sight to see as well. And it rises nearly 2.5 hours just before dawn's first light. And in a telescope, Venus shrinking is barely beginning to turn gibbous just at the moment. So just keep your eye on that one as well. Mars, unfortunately, again, is out of sight because it's behind the glare of the sun. Jupiter, -2.9. I was out last night. Again, it was pretty clear at about 3 o'clock. Was it Monday and Tuesday? Yeah, pretty clear. And it's a fine sight at night at -2.9, virtually overhead at that hour of the evening. And it rises in twilight and dominates the east during the evening, and its highest is in around 1 a.m. where it creeps across the sky, and then it creeps a little bit lower as it goes towards the west. Saturn, +0.7. I did see that tonight because it's not too far away from the moon. And if you look to the, it's about on the 1 o'clock, sort of in between 1 and 2 o'clock, over about 7 degrees, which is about how many fist lengths? About, it's probably really one, isn't it?
Fist length at arm's length.
Yeah.
The width of a fist at arm's length.
Yeah.
I looked at it. It's about 10 degrees. Yeah.
I looked at it. I wasn't
three or four fingers
during the week, and I said, that looks like Saturn to me. That's where it is at the moment. It's pretty high in the sky at the moment, in fact. Uranus, -5.6, very dim. And it's 10 degrees east of Jupiter if you're trying to find your way around the sky to find that little fella. Or should I say a big fella. And Neptune, the last one, -7.8 at the Aquarius-Pisces border. And it's 25 degrees east of Saturn. That's probably about 4, four fists at arm's length thereabouts.
Spread with your fist at arm's length and you extend your thumb as far as you can in one direction and your pinky as far as you can in the other direction.
Pinky.
That's about 20 degrees, but the closed fist is about 10. Speaking of the moon, and you mentioned the moon, John, and the full moon coming up on Saturday the 28th. It's the Hunter's Moon.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And we have, maybe just before I get to what's happening on Saturday with eclipses, just to let you know about the sun and the moon. The moon at present, as you said, you saw it tonight, John, it's a waxing gibbous moon. It's 79% waxing gibbous at the moment. And it will be due south of us at just about 5 to 10 this evening when you will be able to see 80% of the side of the moon facing us will be sunlit. And when it sets tomorrow, just after 3 a.m., you'll be able to see just another 2% more of it. And it will rise again tomorrow at 5:14 in the afternoon. And at that stage, it will be an 87% waxing gibbous moon. As we mentioned, as we head towards the full 100% moon on Saturday, the 28th of October, and that's at 9:24 p.m. And this full moon coincides with a partial lunar eclipse. We will be able to see some of it from Dublin as it happens. And I had my number figures here for it. The times. The show begins, I suppose you could say it, at just after 7 o'clock. But that's the penumbral phase, and the partial eclipse phase begins just about 8:30. Now, you will see it from, as you know, when we normally see the full moon, it's very bright, but it will appear darker around about the bottom of the moon from our point of view, from around the 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock mark on the moon. It'll start to get duller, not as bright as it would normally be, and we'll have maximum eclipse at 14 minutes past 9, which is just around the same time as the moon is full, not surprisingly, and then the partial eclipse ends at 8:52 p.m. but the moon will still be a bit darker than normal because it'll still be in penumbral shape part of the eclipse, and that won't end until just about 25 past 10 this Saturday evening. So what you're seeing is essentially the moon is passing in. The Earth casts a shadow. Of course, we have as everything does, that's facing the sun. Of course, it'll be nighttime here. We'll be on the other side. We won't be able to see the sun, but the Earth casts a shadow, as most things do. And the moon will be passing into that shadow. It won't be a full lunar eclipse, but it will be a partial lunar eclipse where the bottom, round about, as I say, the 6 o'clock to the 8 o'clock mark on the moon will get duller. And the shading is nice, or the colours. What colour it'll be will depend on the amount of, on what type of pollutions there are in the Earth's atmosphere, because the sunlight goes through the Earth's atmosphere and then reflected and refracted over to the moon, depending on what dirt and dust is in it. That will decide the bottom, that bottom part of the moon will be. But it's generally easily browny red, brown or reddish colour.
Yeah, so I'm just looking here, the bits, quite a lot of people will be able to see at least a little bit of it. That'll be 7.5 billion people. We'll be able to see a bit of this. Now, you won't see an awful lot, but of the entire eclipse, just over 6 billion people will be able to see it from beginning until end. And the people that will not, unfortunately, see would be around the Great Lakes of America over to the left, as far as Alaska. Down through Argentina, up through Chile, etc. And that's where they're not going to see. But the rest of us will have a fairly good chance. Yeah, New Zealand's actually in there, has not been able to see the eclipse this
year. That's right, but Australia is in it. All of Africa, all of Asia, all of Europe. And as you said, that's a huge portion of
the planet.
The population of the planet will be able to see. It's unusual from that point of view.
Yep, so that's something to look forward to this weekend. And if it's clear, we may get a little chance to see it as well. I didn't get to see many of the Draconid meteor showers during the beginning of October. And again, the Orion is just over the weekend, peaking 21st into the 22nd. Possibly, mainly because I forgot to look. But I was reminded, and I got a few phone calls to say that people had seen a few of the Orionids. I also get quite a lot of phone calls now to say, I'm sorry I didn't get to listen into the program last night. So there we are. So it's good to see.
Thank you, John, for that. Just finish off with this sunrise tomorrow in Dublin at 8:11 a.m., 15 minutes later than a week ago. Local noon will be at 9 minutes past 1, and the sun will set at 7 minutes past 6, which is 15 minutes earlier than a week ago. And from then until just about 6:45, we'll have civil twilight, and from then until about 25 past 7, we'll have nautical twilight, and then from then until just past 8 o'clock, we'll have astronomical twilight. And from that time, that's just after 8 p.m. onwards, we'll have astronomical night. So that means there'll be 29 minutes less daylight than a week ago. And tomorrow will be 4 minutes and 0 seconds less daylight than today, when there will be 9 hours and 58 minutes between sunrise and sunset. Mm-hmm. And just to remind you, Sunday...
Yeah.
Summertime ends at 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. Clocks go back 1 hour. And I think here's another date for your diary, by the way, on Monday the 30th. If you don't know exactly where the Pleiades are, there'll be 4.5 degrees to the upper right of the moon. Little bunch of stars there.
Now, these are brilliant to look at. If you get a pair of binoculars, you'll get a big surprise when you look through that at the what we call the Little Seven Sisters. This looks like a little pot, but if you look through binoculars or telescope, it just bursts into light.
Oh, thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. The text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. Also available on the internet, dublincityfm.ie. We're live there as a podcast. Also, and just to let you know,
just to let
in
you
two
know.
Weeks' time,
yes.
We will be on at the slightly earlier time of 7:30 p.m., also on a Tuesday evening, but we are moving, we're being brought forward just by a half an hour, and from then on until
whenever,
who knows when.
Mm-hmm.
Until the end of time. Until the end of the universe, perhaps.
Yeah.
We'll be here live every Tuesday evening at 7:30 p.m.
Yeah.
A half an hour earlier than we've been on for the past how many years?
19 or thereabouts.
We went to that one there now.
Yeah. And that starts on the 7th of November. So just put that date in your diary. We will tell you again next week as well. And if you've missed it and you tune in at 8, we will just have finished, or you'll get the run and the outro in as well. So, diary again, a schedule change for our astronomy show on the 7th of November at 7:30 p.m. instead of 8. Now, just picked this one up earlier on today. NASA's Interstellar Voyager probes have got a little software update, beamed from 12 billion miles away, which we are here. And they're trying to keep the innovation, to keep Voyagers exploring interstellar space. So they're quite a long way at this stage. And they're still beaming back a little bit, although it takes a long, long time to do that as well. So this far into the mission, the engineering team has been faced with a lot of challenges. And they just don't have a playbook for this as well. So the project scientists for the mission said in a statement they are continuing with a little bit of software updating as they continue to come up with creative solutions how to keep in touch with Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Now, we all know that they took off in 1977.
I think Voyager 2 took off a couple of weeks before Voyager 1.
Yep. And
are they 12 light hours away?
Something. Yeah, that's...
So you send a signal, takes traveling at the speed of light, it takes 12 hours to get there. That's how far away they are.
Mm-hmm. So we have Voyager 1, 12 billion miles away, and Voyager 2, a slightly different direction and about 15 billion miles away, because one took off earlier than the other. But they really are belting through the universe at the moment at 40,000 miles per hour, which is remarkable. Every single day, every single week, and every single year. So they're hurtling.
Every single second they cover and a number, I don't know how many miles. I'm sure there was only a few weeks between them, so the difference in the distance wouldn't be due to that. It must have something got to do with the planetary swing by his
trajectory,
how many slingshots they got.
Yeah, and I still have a little place in my heart for Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And I remember when they were launched.
And I don't.
That was the year I was leaving school, actually, so I remember that quite well as well. So we keep getting information beam back. Although there's not an awful lot to see up there, out past into interstellar space for goodness knows how long, probably another 400 years or something before they get anywhere near anything.
I think it's more than that. Is it thousands of years before it gets anywhere?
It could very well be. Pity they're not going over towards Betelgeuse. That'll be something
one
to see.
One of them could be going that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's, that's a good one. Now, the moon.
Yes.
Well, let's get back to the moon. Mm. Now, it's now believed to be 40 million years older than previously thought. As you know, John, the Apollo astronauts brought back a lot of samples, and apparently they had the foresight to not go tricking around and analysing all those bits of dust and regolith and rocks that they brought back. They had the foresight to know that in years to come after the last time they took samples back in 72, that there would be improvements in analytical techniques and that they would be able to find out more, I suppose, and do better analysis and more in-depth analysis on some of the samples. I think I read recently that only about half of them have been, examined, and there's still a lot of them still in their containers in pristine condition.
And seemingly the same for asteroid Bennu samples that came back as well. They're going to hold samples back for another 30 to 35 years, maybe even longer, so as the technology increases, they'll be able to see more as technology improves. So that's those are the reasons that they've decided to do this as well. So you've seen a bit of moon rock.
I have seen it. Just looked like a little piece of black, like a bit of anthracite, I suppose it looked like.
Yeah.
And if I saw on the ground, I'd pick it up. Fling it away.
So these are the ones that they've taken from Apollo 17, these samples, and they've locked a lot of them away. But they have done some bits, which is a clever idea when you think about it. Just don't open them all up. So they're all in a safe place.
Mm. So they're looking at zircon crystals, some recent analysis, and they were saying to people who were looking at these that although previous assessments estimated the moon as 4.425 billion years old, the new study discovered it is actually 4.46 billion years older, between 35 and 40 million years older than previously thought using this new technique. But the technique they use is, I suppose, looking at radioactive decay. And if you know the half-life of a radioactive material, the ratio between the pure, the heavier isotope and the lower one, the lighter one, if you know the ratio between them and you know the half-life, then you know how long they've been banging about, I suppose. So, although 40 million years sounds a lot, it's actually what they're really saying is we think it's about 1% older than we originally thought it was. Still, 40 million years is 40 million years. And the people looking at this say, it's important to know, these crystals they found to be 4.46 billion years old. And they say that means the moon must be at least that old, and that it's important to know when the moon formed, because the moon is an important partner in our planetary system. It stabilizes the Earth's rotational axis. It's the reason there are 24 hours in a day. It's the reason we have tides. Without the moon, life on Earth would look different. It's part of our natural system that we want to better understand. And our study, they say, provides a tiny puzzle piece in that whole picture.
Why did we only learn 20 elements from the periodic table?
Because, yeah, I remember, yeah, you said rattle off the first 20, hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, bore you with them, but...
Blah, 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 and finishing with calcium. After that, just scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese.
Well, now, there's 103 when I was doing my leaving cert. But, well, and there some, and, but they've, I don't know what the heaviest one is. There've been some manufactured in the lab bombarding the heavier atoms with neutrons and protons or something. Neutrons, I presume. Well, that would just make new isotopes.
The last one is OG, which is oganesson. Never heard of that one.
No. What's the molecular number of ways?
It's
118. Yeah. So good guess, but that's an artificially produced one. I presume it has a very short, but it decays pretty rapidly. Just to go back to your original point about the first 20 and rattling them off. I did see, what's his name? Daniel Radcliffe, you know, the guy who played Harry Potter, et cetera, the actor, on some show or other. And he, if I'm not mistaken, he rattled off the first 100 in order of increasing atomic number.
I think when you're really young,
I think it was like a song or something. Yeah. Had a certain rhythm to it, whatever way he managed to recite it. But what use is that to you being able to recite? Yeah.
Well, the reason
the whole periodic table
was the question was, how did the universe's elements form? Back at the Big Bang, that's the question as well. So we had seconds after it is when they say they all formed. The journey of the elements has started in the earliest moments of the Big Bang, when the universe was only a few seconds to a few minutes old, and they've been knocking around ever since. So at that time, the entire cosmos was crammed. When I say crammed, it was really crammed into a volume millions times smaller than it was today. And due to the incredibly high densities, the average temperature of all the material in the universe was well over a billion degrees. So that's quite hot. It's remarkable. So all of these started within... Now, where did they come from before that? That's the question.
What triggered the Big Bang? Why did it happen? And the laws of physics and chemistry and reality and time, as we know it, didn't exist before then.
Neutrons, quarks and gluons and all these type of words. Things that we don't really, unless we research and don't understand a thing about them. But similarly, all the universe's elements were all born in the first seconds to minutes of...
Was it not too hot then? For everything would be just be ionized. Was it not? I did read a book some long time ago called The First 3 Minutes. Mm. It's really very, very good and easy enough to understand about it. Basically, it's the first 3 minutes of the universe and what happened. And the temperatures and things start, of course, expand and cool. But I thought it was 100,000 years at least before things got so cool that atoms could form.
You could probably separate them at that stage. Mm. But they were mixed all together in this loopy stuff. So there we go. Lots of books around, Ben. Where are we with the time? Not too bad. Just before I do that, if Perseverance rover found evidence of life on Mars, would we recognize it? That's the question. So, as you know, Perseverance has been scurrying around on the Red Planet, wheeling and dealing around the Jezero crater and inspecting the site of this former lake close-up. Now, evidence is showing that there was a lake up there with some sort of liquid on it as well, but unfortunately we're a little bit too late for it to see exactly what would have happened. So if it came across any microbial communities or life up there, would we be able to recognize them? That's the big question. And that's a lot of experimentation going into that particular question as well. So I'm going to keep an eye on that as well. But I'm sure at some stage they're going to find a building or something up there. Buried with the dust.
I think you're watching too many science fiction movies. Now, black holes. I see researchers in Southampton have shown that it's theoretically possible for black holes to exist in perfectly balanced pairs, held in equilibrium by a cosmological force, so mimicking essentially a single black hole. Now, black holes are massive astronomical objects that have such a strong gravitational pull that nothing, not even light, can escape, and they are incredibly dense. A black hole could pack the mass of the Earth into space the size of a pea. They are so damaging in the whole Earth and crushing it in towards into the size of a pea. That's a lot of matter in a small space and would take an incredible amount of energy. Now, of course, conventional theories about black holes based on Einstein's theory of general relativity, typically explain how static or spinning black holes can exist in their own, isolated in space. Black holes in pairs would eventually be thwarted by gravity, attracting and colliding together, eventually spinning down closer and closer together and then merging and causing these gravitational waves that have recently been detected. However, to say this is true, if you assume that the universe is standing still, but what if it's constantly moving, and could pairs of black holes exist in harmony in an ever-expanding universe? Basically, from our point of view, they would look like one black hole. So what they're saying is it could be a case where there are two black holes and they're spinning around each other and the gravitational forces actually counterbalanced exactly by the expansion of the universe, and that's the way they could go on forever until, or at least until the end of the universe as we know it. So what does that mean exactly? I'm not sure, but it's just another theory about black holes. Yeah. But we don't know of any pairs that are actually in that state of equilibrium.
Yeah, I found you a book, seeing as you're into the wonderful world of the cosmos and something like that. So it's by an artist called Chandra Prescott Weinstein, and it's called The Disordered Cosmos, and it's the journey into dark matter, space-time, and dreams deferred. And it is about two things, really. It's a journey into the world of cosmology and particle physics, which is a little bit, you're sort of more cosmos-y than physics, I think. Yeah, and I have an interest in that. So it's a refreshingly eye-opening insight to the too often exclusionary area in that particular science. So that name again, The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space-Time and Dreams Deferred. I don't think these books are terribly expensive. I don't have a price on it here, but they're all available on the internet.
Mm. Thank you. And I see, just very briefly before we go, that some people in the University of Arizona have suggested that a recently discovered near-Earth asteroid called Kamo-Olawa could be actually a chunk of the moon. They think that's where it originated. It seems to have the same chemical mix as the moon. And it's not that rare as well. There are meteorites that have fallen on Earth, and we've known that they've come from the moon because they have the same, essentially the same composition. But most of them are the near-Earth asteroids seem to be sourced, or originally came from the asteroid belt out there between Mars and Jupiter. But their analysis of some of this seem to think that it is actually was once a part of the moon, which is unusual for the near-Earth asteroid. But that's all the time we have this evening. Thank you for that, John, for your news items this evening. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next is Hello China. 9 o'clock, it's Brian Lynott with Threads, and 11 p.m. it's Nigel Wood with Ear to the Globe. And from midnight till 2 a.m. we have After Hours, which is Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul. But please join myself and John at the same time next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. Say goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.